session number 9437, reel 4.
Elizabeth Hughes, tape 4. So you would have taken the route over the hump, I
yes,
believe.
Yes, yes. But the mountains didn't seem very high, and they were all covered in trees. I suppose it was what I now would call rainforest, because there were trees everywhere. Mind you, we started in the dark, so we didn't see an awful lot, because we started about 4 in the morning, I think, and flew into Zhoujing. I don't remember Kunming. I don't really remember what China looked like, though I suppose I must have seen paddy fields for the first time. Then we went to stay with going from the airport, we had to hang about in the town for a bit to be picked up. And I remember looking round and for the first time being in a foreign country, well, the first time during the war, being in a foreign country where there were no notices whatsoever in English. And the foreigners were definitely inferior to the local inhabitants. Also, everything was dirty and dusty. And I remember standing there and thinking, I'm just never going to ever be clean again. Then we stayed a few days with FAU personnel there in Kunming, and then we travelled up by train to Zhoujing, where the FAU had a hospital of long standing, and a compound where the trucks used to come and the drivers who'd brought stuff up from Burma and were taking it further into China. Shanghai was going to be opened up soon with the end of the Japanese war, and supplies would be coming that way, not having to come up over the hump in the future. And the hospital was being gradually, arrangements were being made to hand it over to Chinese people, and the unit was getting smaller and smaller. we were
How
there.
How did they feel about that, you know, the handing over of the hospital?
They weren't too happy about handing it over to Chinese, because it could be made a very lucrative little place, and it had been run on very open-handed arrangements for the patients. They paid if they could, but we felt that not only would the patients be charged a lot of money, but the treatment was not going to be as good as it had been while they had foreign doctors. Nevertheless, it had to be done. But it was an interesting town. It was a walled town with doors that were closed at night. And I don't think the trucks could get into the town at all. The doors were gates were too small. Outside where the trucks used to collect at night, because it was definitely on a good trade route, there used to be little washstand units with a wash basin and a toothbrush and a mirror and a shaving brush and soap and a razor, where people could and a towel, people could wash in the morning, or I don't think they used to wash at night. And also, something you see all over China is the travelling restaurant, where they have a chow pole, you know, the pole over their shoulders, and on either end there'll be a great gong of rice cooking over a little charcoal fire, and the other side there'll be all the china stacked up and the chopsticks, bowls and plates, and the raw food waiting to be cooked and served for as roadside meals. But you see them all over the place, as well as little fixed stalls.
Is it the case in China you can always get a meal? You know, one says,
I think so.
This.
I think so. I mean, when we were in with MT-19, you obviously got to places where there was absolutely nothing, because there was nothing for sale by anyone in most of the places there. But in most towns and along any well-used road or railway station or something, someone will be there with something to sell, to eat.
Did you gain any impression about the FAU convoy work? You were talking about the trucks outside the wall of Zhoujing. Did you have any idea the sort of work they had been doing?
Well, it was obviously very hard, because the trucks were all falling to pieces. Spares were almost impossible to get. Most of the trucks were run on charcoal, which was you had to be a really good driver to cope with this charcoal. You had to save a minute amount of petrol to get the engine started and get your charcoal fire going and pump it up and all sorts. And you had to nurse your brakes, you had to nurse your tyres, you had to nurse every part of your engine, because you wouldn't be able to get it repaired. I know when we were going a long journey up and down hills, and the roads are often very badly, not well built, and liable to collapse or be covered with rocks from above, and the engine isn't too good. Somebody has to stand behind the truck as it goes up hills with a chock, so that if the engine cuts out, you can chock the wheel before it starts running backwards over the edge. And sometimes, of course, they do run over the edge. It's not exactly straightforward motoring. When people complain of blocks on the M2, they don't know what they're talking about.
So would you have had any work with the hospital in Jujing?
Yes, I worked there for a bit. The most common serious accident was accidents on the railway. People would come in who'd fallen under railway tracks and had their limbs more or less amputated. I can remember almost the last operation I saw was somebody who had to have a leg had nearly been amputated by the train, completely removed. And the surgeon brought the relations in to have a look at him on the table with this enormous gaping wound at the stump of his leg, to demonstrate that if he died, there really was some pretty good reason why they hadn't been able to save him.
Would that have been necessary for the surgeon to have demonstrated that?
This was actually the Chinese doctor that was taking over. I don't know whether the foreigner, you know, the English doctors would have done.
That implies that they might have blamed the
medical people. Oh, yes. I know a baby was born dead when I was there, and the father was suing, you know, trying to sue the hospital because saying it was our fault. I think in Nationalist China they were pretty sharp like that. And were a bit frightened of the foreigners. But this time it was a Chinese doctor obviously doing it to cover himself in case they were upset if things went wrong. But wherever there were trains, they were always so terribly overcrowded that these accidents happened quite often, and they used to start unexpectedly. And there were quite often accidents. In Zhengzhou we got a lot too.
What was your impression of the medical facilities there?
There, they weren't too bad, though they were only just beginning to cement the floors. They'd been dirt floors till then. They were doing them while we were there. But in the wet cement, there were nice little rat footmarks all across the wet cement, so that shows what the hospital was like. But it wasn't too bad. The ordinary medical supplies had come through all right.
And drugs, would you have had enough drugs?
There were enough, yes, there were there. mainly because I suppose, that the FAU were bringing them into China from Burma, and Jujing was more or less the first stop.
Did you get an impression in Jujing of the level of public health in China in that area?
Yes, it was quite low. There were still prisoners sweeping the streets, prisoners in irons, acting as road sweepers. There'd be three or four of them chained together with a guard. I don't think I saw that anywhere else in China, and then they go back to the prison at night.
And people's living conditions?
They were primitive, but they had enough, I think. There were beggars, though, and the things like you see in India, where people were with broken limbs or deformities, were exploited as beggars.
Did you meet many of the nationalist soldiers in that area, or did you see them?
I think I saw them walking around, but I don't remember them being very prominent, because the fighting was a good long way away from there.
How quickly did you become aware of the political situation in China? This would have been after the end of the war with Japan, wouldn't it?
This was after the end of the war with Japan, but it was quite obvious that the war was not over between the Nationalists and the Communists. In fact, it flared up after the end of the Japanese War. Then they felt they were turning to the other struggle, because the Communists had been fighting the Japanese as well as the Nationalists, and they had been fighting each other. But that left the end of the Japanese War meant they were free to merely struggle for power and literally fight for land. The Communists held most of the rural areas, but the Nationalists at that time held most of the railways and the main roads.
How about the Western presence? We're now talking about southwest China, aren't
yes.
we?
I don't remember in southwest China there being many foreigners except the FAU. There wasn't any mission in Jujing.
How about Americans?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, there were some American soldiers, yes. They were, well, it lowered my respect for the lower-class Americans. They sat around in their bunkhouses reading literally children's comics or that type of paper. They didn't seem to me to be at all intelligent or aware of anything except the fact that they hadn't got this, they hadn't got that. One thing China does produce, the Southwest China, in enormous quantities, is peanuts. But they were still flying in tinned peanuts from America. And, of course, they left a lot of stuff behind, which the FAU made very good use of.
How about the FAU members there? Can you remember any outstanding people or people who impressed you that you remember?
Oh, dear.
In Jujing?
Yes.
In 1946?
Yes. Do you know, I can't remember any names. I can see some faces, but I just can't remember the names. They'd probably be very... actually, I should remember some of them, because I've known them later, and they carried on... Some of them came up to central China, but most of them were due to go home. And there was Sydney, somebody, Archer, a New Zealander. He stayed on in China, not with the FAU. He went up to Laoshan or somewhere. He was hospital manager. I can't remember the names of anyone. There was a Canadian. I can remember him cooking a baked ham with pineapple. I don't know where he got it from. Yunnan, actually, was very famous for ham, that area. Very good it was, too. It was the first time we English people had eaten ham with pineapple, which is such a commonplace thing these days.
Did you hear anything about Bob McClure, the surgeon?
Oh, yes. Everyone talked about him. But I didn't meet him until I got to Zhengzhou, which was near the where he'd been born and brought up. He left very soon after we got to Zhengzhou, and I really only remember him personally because he had to shoot all the dogs on the compound because of the rabies when we got there. And a few days after that, he went. But his name was everywhere. And always anecdotes about him. And I met him in Canada later and was very pleased that we were able to sit and listen to him reminiscing.
Was he quite a character?
Oh, absolutely. Tremendous character, yes.
What was it about him?
Terrific worker. He had this marvellous ability to see what a situation needed and what could be done with the most limited resources. And he got the best out of everyone. And made everyone do things they didn't think they were capable of doing. Yes, the FAU convoys used to stay at Jujing in the compound before they went further into China with their drugs. And sometimes the journeys were fairly hazardous because of bandits. And there was an occasion when... a convoy was actually captured by bandits, and one of the people included was Lord Hugh Russell, who, to everyone else, was just another member of the FAU. And they were in a very difficult position because the bandits were trying to ransom them and so on. And in the end, the Chinese army had to go in and more or less rescue the FAU, which was a rather difficult situation. I don't think they had been harmed, although I believe some of them were beaten with the flat of a sword. But nothing more was ever said about this incident.
Well, did that create a dilemma? You know,
well, it was very difficult. I was not an executive, and I hadn't been there long, so I wasn't really involved. But I think it was very difficult for the people in charge to decide whether it should be allowed to go. Well, how the situation should be handled.
Yes, how much consultation would there have been with an issue like that?
Fairly good. Oh, you mean within the unit?
Yes, I wondered how much...
I don't know. I think there must have been an executive committee that would have dealt with it. But communications between different parts of China were not good, not quick at all. So I think probably the local people would have had to have dealt with it.
You mentioned earlier on, you know, that this was Lord Hugh Russell, who was just Hugh Russell to the rest
of
us, sort of implying that you considered yourselves all equal.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Did you find this really worked? You know, that
it did within the unit, but I can remember in Zhengzhou there were some Mennonite nurses, and working in the area, and they came to me one day and said, "Is that man really a lord?" And we had to assure her that, yes, he was at home, but here with the FAU, he was just another member. Mind you, he was a very good driver. He'd been taught to drive on the Bedford in the Woburn Estates by the chauffeur on a Rolls Royce who used to have him changing gear without using the clutch. And he was a good, reliable driver, even with the old charcoal burners.
When you think of the composition of the FAU in China, you know, what social class do you think?
Well, it was taken from absolutely all social classes.
Would you?
And several nationalities. You see, there were a lot of Canadians, a lot of New Zealanders, quite a number of Chinese too, and quite a lot of Americans.
Did that make it different from the FAU elsewhere?
It was rather different. It was rather nice because it was even more mixed than the FAU in other parts of the world. It was really splendid with such a wonderful mixture of all people who, to start with, were a little bit different by wanting to join the FAU.
And how about the proportion of women?
Oh, there were very, very few women.
What proportion do you think in China?
Oh, about... To start with, there were no women at all, and gradually a few came in, and most of them were married or soon got married. I should think there was not more than 1 to 100, I should think. Possibly by the end there were a few more.
And how about Quakers? How many would you think?
Well, again, there weren't so very many Quakers, only a little bit more. Oh, perhaps a good deal, but perhaps 10% were Quakers, but I don't think much more than that. Although most of the Americans... And New Zealanders, they were Quakers, but the people from England, I shouldn't think, perhaps as high as 20%, 25%, but not more among the English. I think I said that the work in West China was diminishing because of the expected opening up of Shanghai. Consequently, the hospital and the hostel in Zhujing was being closed, and everyone was moving up to Honan, to Zhengzhou, where the FAU was starting on a new phase of its existence, intending to open up mission hospitals and mission centres that had been left by the missionaries during the war with the Japanese and left either to the Japanese or to local people. It was felt that most missionaries were more elderly people, and that the younger, more mechanically minded FAU were very suitable people to get the buildings and facilities in working order before the missionaries returned. There was a big hospital compound in Zhengzhou, and this was made the headquarters for repairs of trucks and vehicles, and also apparatus like X-ray apparatus and so on, hospital apparatus. So there was a good hospital there, and the buildings, when I saw them, were in good repair. The hospital was working again when we got there, and the garage mechanics were all working too on as well. Our journey was first of all by truck, which was a pretty hair-raising journey. We'd stop overnight, and usually Eric and I would sleep in an inn. But somebody always slept on the truck, and often the drivers and all their passengers would sleep on the truck or under the truck. Even so, sometimes money and goods would be stolen. Chinese are expert at managing to acquire other people's property. We'd eat, of course, real Chinese food prepared in Chinese restaurants. Because of the method of cooking in China, their food is usually quite safe because everything is served boiling hot. They never drink anything but except tea or just plain boiling water. They are most particular about that. So the danger is not great. The habit is to wipe your face and hands with a hot towel at the end of a meal, except that they advise that you don't wipe your eyes because of... I can't think of the illness of the eyes. That's a very pleasant habit, and of course the airlines do it now, don't they, with all their napkins. They're not boiling hot though. You'd see them get, there'd be a great pot full of these boiling towels, and they'd get them out, little hand towels, they'd get them out and they'd wring them with chopsticks and throw them across the restaurants to the person who, to the waiter of the table where the people were leaving. It was, you know, rather jolly. I haven't seen them do that in Soho yet.
And you say you could spread eye disease.
Possibly even
trachoma,
trachoma, that's the word I'm thinking of, which is quite prevalent. Anyway, we eventually got to Changsha, where several members of our party were ill, and so we hung about there some time and visited various American missionaries, as far as I remember, there. And then we went to go on by boat, and it was quite a big barge, and we loaded all our stuff on, and this dog that we'd brought with us all this time, Billy, he was called, and we were meant to start during the night, and we didn't move, no great arguments, and then there was a great explosion, and the boiler had burst and scalded three or four of the Chinese on board. Two of them had inhaled steam and were in a very, very bad way, and another chap was scalded all down his leg. This is about the first time in my, and only time in my life I've given first aid, because I had with me some American Army ampules of morphine, and I felt these people certainly needed it. And rather than, I hardly bothered to dress their wounds, but I pumped some morphine into them, and they were taken off to the local hospital. Two of them died pretty soon, which didn't surprise me at all. And I don't know whether the man with the leg got better. I think he probably did, unless he died of sepsis later. But the reason the boiler had exploded was that the Kuomintang army had come along and told the captain of the barge that he was to tow a couple of army boats behind his boat. And although he said the boat wasn't strong enough, the army captain officer insisted. So he put another weight on the safety valve, but nevertheless the boiler blew up. So I don't know whether they repaired the boiler. Anyway, we went off quite soon. I don't remember much about this trip, though it must have lasted more than a day. I know we had great problems with the dog, trying to make him perform. At last he condescended to do it on a pile of coal. And I don't even remember what food we had, but we must have eaten. So then we got to Hung Kao, and we stayed there a couple of nights, I think, and visited quite a big American hospital, where there was an American nurse who showed me the state of all her thing, all her leather shoes in the hot, humid atmosphere, the mould growing everywhere. And then we went on from there up by train. It was a newly opened railway that had run from Canton right up to Peking, but they'd got the central bit running again. I think it was a very crowded journey, but I don't remember it very clearly. When we got to Zhangzhou, as I say, the hospital was functioning quite well under, what's her name, Wu, a Chinese nurse who later married one of the English doctors. They live in England now. Wilkes, she married. And anyway, Eric and I went to bed the first night in a ground floor room built on the Japanese pattern with sliding windows. And during the night, a dog came into our room, and he seemed a bit peculiar, and he bit my foot through my sleeping bag. Fortunately, my husband had big leather gloves and his greatcoat by him, and shooed the dog out of the window. If we'd realised what it was all about, we wouldn't have done that, because the dog had rabies, and after we'd shooed him out, he bit three or four other people around the compound. My skin was only just broken, so the danger wasn't very great, but nevertheless, rabies is such that you don't play jokes with it. And a message was sent to Shanghai immediately, and doses of vaccine were sent for everyone who'd been bitten. And this involved having a daily injection for 13 days in your abdomen, which wasn't all that much fun. But, anything would be better than rabies.
Have you seen rabies yourself?
Later we saw patients with rabies, and it is absolutely terrible. The patient is so frightened, and so it's quite, once the disease has developed, it's impossible. Well, at that time anyway, there was no way of treating it whatsoever. All you can do is sedate the patient, but that will probably hasten their death, eventual death.
What is so awful about babies?
Well, their throats are paralysed and they can't drink. And so they salivate and they want water, but they can't swallow. And they become mad and from lack of fluid and so on. And they die in real agony. They don't fall into a coma soon at all, and it's very terrible to see. It takes them several days to die, which is, it's terrible when you know you can't treat them. They're very restless and vicious. It's very, very terrible. Or when this they found this dog had rabies, that's when Dr. McClure shot all that dog and this one we'd brought with us from Shanghai, from Kunming, and all the there were several other dogs on the compound. He was the only person I think who would have done it so cool-headedly.
So was that a risk you always had to face?
Yes. There's quite a lot of rabies in China. Of course, I expect there are lots of wolves and foxes. I expect even if they got it out of the dog population, it would be stay in the wolves. I don't know what they do now. Then the Chinese can be quite ruthless.